Good evening. Would you please turn in your Bibles to 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, 1 Peter 5. Good to see everyone here this evening. Hope you had a good afternoon. Sometimes, even for Christians, life has great difficulties. I think it's easy for some people to think that if they become a Christian, it's going to not only solve their eternal problem, not only solve the problem with sin, but it's going to solve all the problems that they have in this life. And I want you to understand that's not strictly true. When Christians sometimes lose their health, it's something that can serve as a great discouragement because we live in a day and time in which instead of recognizing our own health as being that cross to bear, it's easy for us to assume that good health is just the norm. And in fact, that's one of the reasons we take so much more medication than people throughout the ages have done, because we think that if I've got a headache, I need to solve this headache, take some aspirin, or take some Tylenol, or take something, gets rid of this because the normal is feeling good. That hasn't been the way people have always thought about it. But we have to understand that in spite of the fact that we're Christians, we're not only going to have headaches, but we're going to have breakdowns in our health from time to time. We live in a body that wasn't made to last forever here. And so we find ourselves sometimes losing health, and that serves as a discouragement spiritually to some people who face that. Sometimes there's a loss of wealth. People may save and invest and work hard to try to be able to save something up for a rainy day. And as we've known who have gone through recessions, and some of you gone through depressions, you realize that you can't even completely count on the money that we have and the financial security that we have as a country. We are indeed blessed beyond people throughout the ages in being able to have a lifestyle that others could barely imagine. But you know, we can't always count on that because there are ups and downs in the economies of nations. There are times in which there are complete utter collapses in the currency or the economy of nations. There have been times in which I remember reading about post-World War I Germany, in which the mark, which was their currency at the time, was so inflated in value that there were people who could take sheets of marks and wallpaper their houses with them because currency was cheaper than wallpaper was. We need to realize that in spite of the fact that we assume security is always going to be the case, there are financial setbacks that even Christians can face. Sometimes there can be a loss of status. Have you ever been in a situation in which you did not get a raise that you thought you ought to get, or sometimes maybe even a demotion at work because of circumstances beyond your control? There are some times in which we may lose status because of things far beyond our control. We have to recognize that we live in a world in which there is difficulty, in which there is strife, in which there are things that can discourage us and make it harder for us to live as Christians. But I want to talk tonight about the importance of making sure that in spite of those setbacks that we may have, in spite of the fact that things go wrong sometimes, we still need to put our trust and our confidence in God as the one who we can trust in, when we may not be able to trust in the economy, when we may not be able to trust in modern medicine, when we may not be able to trust in the vicissitudes of our culture and the group that we're around in maintaining our self-esteem. I like 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, verses 6 and 7, where it talks about the kind of relationship that we need to have with God. It says, beginning in verse 6, "Therefore humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." One of the things that we need to remember as we face difficulties in life, when things seem to go wrong, is that we can cast all our anxieties upon God. If we humble ourselves before him, We are promised ultimate exaltation, maybe not even in this life, but certainly ultimate exaltation in heaven. Therefore, the anxieties that sometimes affect us to such an extent that we worry about what we're going to eat, and we worry about how we're going to be clothed, and we worry about where we're going to stay, these need to be things that we cast that anxiety on the Lord, realizing that He's the one who can, because He cares for us, bear us up and encourage us during discouraging times. The book of Revelation talks to a group of people who were facing a situation in which things definitely seemed to go wrong. Here they were New Testament Christians. If God is concerned about any people, it certainly ought to have been those that were trying to serve Him and do His will. But yet, if the book of Revelation was written at the time that I believe that it was written, it was written at a time in which the government was beginning to notice the difference between Jews that they didn't particularly care for and Christians that did not have some of the protections that had been built in to the Jewish system after the Jewish War in the late 60s and 70 AD. Under those circumstances, the Romans realized that the Jews were not going to fall down and worship the emperor in the same way that others had done. So late in the 90s, they wind up being exempted from those things. But Christians, in spite of their background, many of whom are Jews, were not exempted from that particular status. And we find them being persecuted in terrible ways toward the end of the century. We find them being faced with problems within the church and without the church. Things seem to be going wrong because of all the people you would think God would protect, you think it would be His people. But yet things seem to be falling apart. In the second chapter of the book of Revelation, in verses 2 and 3, there it emphasizes the idea that there were congregations, as we see churches across Roman Asia addressed here in chapters 2 and 3, that were being faced with evil men. I sure wish it was the case that no congregation ever had to face dealing with men that were evil, trying to stir up strife and difficulty, trying to lead brethren astray with false doctrine or immorality. But yet, in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 2, we see that's exactly what the church at Ephesus had to undergo. He says, I know your deeds and your toil and your perseverance, and you cannot tolerate evil men. And you put to the test those who call themselves apostles, and they are not. And you found them to be false. And you've perseverance and have endured for my sake and have not grown weary. Here is a congregation that's praised because they did not tolerate evil men. They put people to the test who claimed to be apostles. But yet, think how difficult that had to be on a congregation, how divisive that could become, how necessary it was, but yet how painful it had to be when the very church itself seems to be infected with the problems that the world at large seemed to face. As Jesus Himself talks to the church at Smyrna, He notices another problem that existed among them that would have been discouraging as Christians looked and said things seemed to be going wrong. In verse 9 of chapter 2, He says, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Here He talks about the poverty of a particular congregation. And while that doesn't seem to be the case with most of us here in this day and time, there are no assurances that poverty won't return to some of us as it was in the days of our youth. We need to recognize that some of the people that are described here were people who, He says, ultimately you're rich because they were rich spiritually. But in terms of this world's goods, they didn't possess them. And to some people, that seemed to be a discouragement because it seemed like things were going wrong. In verses 9 and 10 of chapter 2, you notice He talked about the blasphemy of those that were Jews but were not. And He goes on in verse 10 to say, do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison so that you'll be tested and you'll have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Here were Christians that are told, you're going to be put in prison. Now, how can that be? We are good citizens because we are Christians, but yet we're being thrown into prison like we're criminals? Tribulation was something that they were going to face. And in fact, he says you'll have tribulation for 10 days. Probably an indication of it being a rather short time rather than a rather long time. But he said tribulation is coming and you need to be prepared for it because it will seem like things have gone wrong. Of all the things, it would seem that God would protect us from it would be that, but the Lord is letting them know that in this world there's going to be discouragement. There are things that look like they're turning out wrong. And this tribulation was something they were going to have to face for a short time. You know, people can put up with a lot of things for a short period of time. There are several ladies in this room who have had babies, some of them recently. And what is interesting about that is not only have people had first babies recently, but there are people who have had a second, third, or fourth baby recently. Now, you would think that the pain of childbirth, and I've been fortunate enough to be there every time my wife gave birth, and best I could tell, she wasn't having a good time. Under those circumstances, you can understand why a woman could put up with it, but yet, when you talk about a second child, you would think that most women would say, you know, listen, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But because the pain is of short duration, and women sometimes have bad memories, isn't it interesting, have long memories as far as their husbands and short memories in reference to their children. That's strange, isn't it? But go on and have second, third, fourth. Some people, a lot of children. It's because they can put up with just about anything for a short period of time. And I think that's what's being done here when the church at Smyrna is talked to about the tribulation that they'll face. But you notice, just like tribulation that they face, there may be tribulation that we face at times during our lives. And in verse 13 of chapter 2, when he talks to the church at Pergamum, he even raises the specter of persecution to the point of martyrdom. In verse 13, there, as Jesus addresses the Pergamum church, he says, I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast my name, and do not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. Here he addresses the fact that there had been Christians among them who had lost their lives. And you can certainly understand how people would look at that and say, that's just terribly wrong. Has God forgotten about us? Is our faith vain? Is there something wrong with what we're doing that's made God abandon us? All of those questions are questions that people can ask when they are facing things going wrong. And when I'm talking about going wrong, it may not be in your life the dreadful things that we see described here. Basically, when a Christian faces anything that they never expected to happen to them, it can cause discouragement and frustration and difficulty. I think it's important for us to recognize that if we're going to be able to overcome difficult times like this, we're going to have to show perseverance. Do you remember in chapter 2 and verse 2, we talked about how that the church at Ephesus had been one that had shown perseverance in the face of evil men. They had hung in there like a hare in a biscuit when things got difficult, and they continued to serve God and do His will. He says, I know your deeds and your toil and perseverance. In verse 3, he talks about, and you have perseverance and have endured for my name's sake and have not grown weary. It's important that we, when we face difficult times, when we face times where things seem to go wrong, that we hang in there, that we don't give up, that we continue to serve God even under difficult times. We need to endure for the name of the Lord. In fact, as it talks about that in verse 3 that we just saw, he says, "For you have perseverance and have endured for my name's sake." We need to endure. We need to realize that staying afloat, staying in the fight, making sure that we don't give up, is something that is important for Christians when they face the difficulties of things going wrong, to the point that we continue to endure for the Lord's name's sake, because we want to live consistently with His will and consistently with His authority. And, as it said in verse 13 that we looked at a minute ago in chapter 2, that you have held fast my name. It's important for us to hold fast the name of the Lord, as these people at Pergamum are said to have done, to make sure that it's not something that we easily abandon. That just because we can't understand what's going on, it's important for us to realize that faith means serving God even though we can't see the way things are operating. We need to operate by faith and not by sight, as we're told in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter in verse 7. "For we walk by faith and not by sight." Sometimes there are ways we're not going to be able to see how things are going to turn out. Sometimes not even be able to see the way things turn out in this life. But put trust and faith and confidence in the Lord as time goes on, and realize that the Lord will ultimately be the one who makes all things right, who serves us in the wonderful capacity of, if we hold fast His name, that He'll hold fast our names in the book of life. Do you remember in the 10th chapter of the book of Matthew, verses 32 and 33, Jesus says, "If you confess me before men, I'll confess you before my Father in heaven. But if you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father who is in heaven." That ought to be our concern, rather than trying to judge God in His rule of the universe, and trying to determine, well, this is just what ought not to be. This shouldn't be happening to me. We should be people who recognize, you know, why not me? We live in a world in which we stand on the battle line fighting against Satan, and sometimes there are spiritual casualties. Always there are going to be physical casualties. As we live lives in which sometimes we are always not living in a bed of roses. But sometimes we have to face the difficulties that come from the cosmic struggle in which we are engaged. We have to be people who don't deny the name of the Lord. You remember in chapter 2 and verse 13, again, as it talks about those at Pergamum, even though they lived where Satan's throne was, He says, you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas. In chapter 3 and verse 8, when he talks about to the church at Philadelphia, he says, "I know your deeds, and behold, I have put before you an open door which no one can shut, because you have a little power, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name." In times of difficulty, it's given me great comfort to know that the Lord will confess my name one day before all who have ever lived and all the angels of heaven if I confess Him before men. But you know, if I deny Him before men, it terrifies me to know that when the only thing that matters is if the Lord owns my name, that He would deny me. You see, even in the difficult times that we face, even when things seem to go wrong, our trust needs to go with the Lord as we cast all our anxiety upon Him. As we face difficult times, that we continue to show perseverance, that we continue to endure for the Lord's name, that we hold fast His name, that we not deny the faith, and in doing so, make sure that we show ourselves assured of the victory that the Lord is going to hold out for those that love Him. There are some powerful things that the Lord promises for those who endure, just like these brethren in Roman Asia were able to endure even when things seemed to go wrong. You notice to the church at Ephesus in chapter 2, he says in verse 7 that he would allow them to partake of the tree of life. We see the tree of life last in the Garden of Eden, and it's taken away so that man won't eat of its fruit and live forever in a condition of rebellion against the Lord. But you remember in the book of Revelation, when we see the saints finally safe, victorious, at home with God, the tree of life there is restored, and it bears its fruits every month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. We need to recognize that if we continue to tolerate the difficulties of this life, in spite of the discouragement that they provide us, then we'll be able to eat of the tree of life and live forever as the Lord intended for us. We see also, as he talks to the church at Smyrna in chapter 2 and verse 11, he tells them that they would be able to not taste of the second death. And you remember, the second death is not just this body dying, but it's being cast into hell eternally. And here we'll be able to avoid that if we continue to confess the Lord rather than denying Him when things don't seem to go in a way that we understand. To the church at Pergamum, he promises them the hidden manna and a white stone. Two illustrations that are used here. One is the manna that was provided in the wilderness was something that always served as a fascination for the Jews. The fact that the Lord could take 3 million people approximately and feed them every day in an area that had more in common with the surface of the moon than it has with Kentucky, where we live, is amazing. It shows the power of God. And here, this power of God is the kind of thing that is displayed for those that overcome at Pergamum. Here he promises them the hidden manna. You remember when people ate of the loaves and the fishes with Jesus, as it's recorded in the book of John. It tells us in chapter 6 that they were going all around the Sea of Galilee to try to find him, to come and make him a king by force. And Jesus says, "You don't follow me for anything but the fact that you ate of the loaves and the fishes and were fed." They thought of the manna that Moses gave them in the wilderness. There is a sense in which we find that those who endure are the ones who are going to be eternally sustained by the sustenance that the Lord provides through His Word and His will. But also the white stone was something that was important in the ancient world as people cast lots. You ever drawn straws or done something that would determine which one was able to get the larger part of what you were dividing up? What they would do in ancient times is take a pot or a part of a pot, put rocks in there, and put one white rock in there. And the one who got the white rock was the one who was able to gain the prize or whatever it was that was in contest. And notice, this particular stone is not only a white stone, but it is a stone that it says in verse 17 of chapter 2. He says, "It has a new name written on the stone which no one knows but the one that receives it." We can be God's elect people. We can be the ones that the Lord has chosen, the one who that He chose to redeem, the ones He chooses to save on the basis of the blood of Jesus Christ, with a brand new name, because we are new creatures, because we have been chosen and possess the white stone that He has in store for those that love Him. To Thyatira, in chapter 2, verses 26 through 28, He promises them authority over the nations and the morning star. Can you imagine being able to bask in the glow of the Lord who has authority over the nations? You remember in the 18th verse of Matthew 28, there Jesus says, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." And here, for us to be able to participate in that new order that is provided by the Lord, to have authority over the nations, and we are the ones who have submitted ourselves first to the one who has all of that authority. And the morning star. Here, the morning star is always the indication that daylight is around the corner. And yet they lived in a world in which, because of persecution and execution of Christians, it was easy to think that everything's going wrong. Night is setting. He lets them understand that the morning star signifies a brand new day, a new change in the way things are going to operate, one that will be to their eternal benefit. In Sardis, in chapter 3 and verse 5, he promises them to be clothed in white garments. Sin dirties our garments, but can you imagine being prepared for the wedding feast of the Lamb by being given new clothes that are clean and pure instead of the dirty clothes that we've had to carry around with us in this life? That the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses, but yet we continue to be affected by sin. It's wonderful to think of being able to stand pure and clean in the eyes of the Lord. To the church at Philadelphia, in chapter 3 and verse 12, he says, "For the one who overcomes, I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God." It's reminiscent of what we see in 1 Peter, the second chapter, where he talks about us being living stones, building up the temple of God. Here he describes them as being pillars in the temple of his God. Completed pillars, of which we are living stones. But imagine being able to be part of the Lord's house, part of the Lord's temple, part of that great structure that is being built even as we live, as those who are in the world wind up giving up the world and its ways through the blood of Jesus Christ and being built into that holy temple for the Lord and His service. Even at the church at Laodicea in chapter 3 and verse 21, he promises to the overcomers that he would grant to them to sit down with me on my throne. Again, can you imagine to be able to bask in the glow of the victory that the Lord has, not over the nations, but over sin and over all the difficulty and all the frustrations that we face, into an environment in which there's not going to be stress, in which there's not going to be temptation, in which there's not going to be sin, in which there's not going to be illness, in which there's not going to be death? Can you imagine sitting with the Lord on His throne? To be able to bask in the glory and the victory that the Lord has finally achieved. You see, we need to make sure that we cast our anxieties on the Lord when things seem to go wrong. But we need to recognize that even when brethren in the book of Revelation saw things going wrong round about them, the Lord acknowledges their difficulty. But He lets them understand there are ways to overcome that. And He promises to the overcomers great things that He has in store for those that love Him. I want to conclude with one example from the Old Testament that is one of my favorites about people who served God even when it seemed like things were going wrong. You remember in the third chapter of the book of Daniel, we see Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, being assigned to duty in the plain of Dura. And it is during their tenure there that we see Nebuchadnezzar, the autocrat that he was, determining that he was going to build a great statue. And that statue was going to be 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide, made of gold. And he also decreed that every time a particular combination of instruments was played, that everyone had to bow down and worship the image that he'd set up. In verse 5, it says, "The moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you're to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had a problem, though, because they couldn't get over the idea that the Lord had said in the Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, and thou shalt have no other gods besides me." And they weren't going to bow down before this golden image like it was a god. And so, when the music was played, here you have servants of Nebuchadnezzar who do not bow down, but who continue to stand when the king has given this order. There are people who are obviously ready to tattle on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego because of the fine position that they hold and the status that they've gained with Nebuchadnezzar. And they want to do anything they can to chop them down. So they report this apparent rebellion to Nebuchadnezzar. And it tells us in verse 13 of chapter 3, "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then these men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Now if you're ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I've made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hand?'" That had to be intimidating, to be in a situation in which you have someone who holds your life in his hand, ready to cast you into a furnace of blazing fire that will almost certainly lead to your death. But yet I want you to notice the response that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have to Nebuchadnezzar over this. And I think it shows their willingness to serve God in spite of the fact that things seem to be going wrong. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter." I used to think they were kind of sassing him. You know, "We don't need to give you an answer about this." But I don't think that's the idea. I think they're saying, "We don't need time to formulate an answer, because the answer we're going to give you right now is the same answer that we would give after consulting our lawyer in an hour or two, the same answer that we would give you in next week, the same answer we'd give you next month, the same we'd give you next year, the same we would give you in 50 years. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire." You remember Nebuchadnezzar had said, "What God can deliver you out of my hand?" They said, "Our God can." Now we need to be people who, when times get difficult, we believe that our God can deliver us from the difficulties of life. But you notice he continues and said, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." Not only do we believe that our God can deliver us, but we believe our God will deliver us. What faith, what confidence in the Lord at a situation in which it looks like all hope is gone because they're not going to bow down before that image, and Nebuchadnezzar is mad and he's looking at the furnace. But I think the greatest thing that they say is what's said in verse 18, where they say, "But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Our God can deliver us. We believe our God will deliver us. But even if he doesn't, we're going to keep faith with God rather than fold up like a cheap suit in front of you. Now, you know the story. That wasn't quite the answer that Nebuchadnezzar was expecting. And he grew so angry, he told them to fire up the furnace 7 times hotter than it had ever been heated up before. He had Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bound and cast into the furnace. And the furnace was so hot it burned up the men who brought them close enough to throw them in. And then he sets back to look. Then Nebuchadnezzar said to his high official in verse 24, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" And they replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." And he said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Here we see, I think, the Lord's presence among them. At a time in which they were facing difficulty, at a time when things were going terribly wrong, Yet because of their faith and confidence in the Lord and their willingness to follow the Lord, even if He didn't vote their ticket, even if He didn't do what they expected, the Lord delivers them so that finally when they're called forth from the furnace, there's nothing about them that is burned. There's nothing about them that is singed. Their clothes aren't even singed. There's not even the smell of smoke on them. And Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 29, says, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, insomuch as there is no other God who's able to deliver in this way." We need to understand that things aren't always going to work out like we expect them to. But we need to cast all our anxieties on the Lord because He cares for us. We need to look at the book of Revelation and recognize that here are people who were facing a situation that was the opposite of what they expected. But yet the Lord doesn't tell them to pray for the fact that this persecution would be alleviated, but He tells them to remain firm, to hold fast, to show perseverance, to endure. And those that do endure, those that are the overcomers, will be ones who are given powerful blessings that only the Lord can bestow. And we also need to understand that the God that we serve is one who can deliver us from anything that comes along. And I think our faith needs to be that He will deliver us from those things that happen. Just like we saw in the church at Philadelphia, the difficulties they faced were only going to be 10 days, just a short period of time. And in the broad scheme of things, whatever we suffer are things that are just for a short period of time when you compare it to the eternity of heaven. But we need to understand that sometimes even if we don't see God doing what we expected, we still need to be people who keep faith with God and do His will, realizing that if we remain faithful unto death, as it says in Revelation 2:10, He'll give us the crown of life. How are things going in your life? I hope they're going well. But you know, whether you're a Christian or not, there are things that aren't going to turn out exactly like you expected. The only solution to the problems of this life is to have things prepared to spend eternity with God by and by. To come in faith, show it through repentance, confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and we can baptize you tonight so that you can leave this place washed in the blood of the Lamb. You can have yourself steeled against the difficulties of life because you may not know what the future holds, but you know who holds the future. And if you as a child of God have lost faith in God because life has grown discouraging to you, you need to find that faith once again. And you need to hold fast to the Lord's name. And you need to not deny Him before men. Because there'll come a day in which the only thing that matters is whether you've confessed Him in this life and remained true to the God who loves you, gave Himself for you, and is willing to ultimately save you if you remain faithful unto death. Think about these things, and if we can help anyone as they make things right with God this evening, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.